past 10.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been close to 8 years since that April early morning in Natal, South Africa. I had the privilege to be among the reporters at the Ohlange School in a village called Inanda. We were outside, on grass still wet with dew, watching in near reverence as a tall man in a loose-fitting, lemon-colored shirt walked out of the school with a piece of paper in his hand. It was quiet, just the sounds of birds and cameras clicking. Then the man, Nelson Mandela, took the piece of paper, it was a ballot, and for the first time in his life, he slipped the paper into a box and voted.
We sincerely hope that by the mere casting of a vote, the result will give hope to all South Africans and will make us, all South Africans, realize that this is our country. We are one nation.
Another remarkable event came a year later, when another man, not quite as tall, but every bit as much the statesman, took on the leadership of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. His name, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Now, if he hadn't already won a Nobel Peace Prize 11 years earlier for his own stance against apartheid, he certainly would have won it for the courage he showed in guiding South Africa through 3 years of exercising the hatred and the violence and the blame. Desmond Tutu is a retired archbishop today, but at age 70, he is no less active. Connection listeners, Desmond Tutu is joining us today for a conversation about the evolving relationship between Africa and the West, and to share some of his thoughts about the ongoing struggle for democracy and against evil. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And so I begin by welcoming Father Tutu into the Connection studio.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Lovely to have you here.
Wonderful to be in this place and see the weather changing from the snow, and now it looks like spring is really in the air.
I was thinking as I listened to Nelson Mandela talk about voting, about the news that we're watching today from Zimbabwe, a crucial election in that country, and I know one that you're watching very carefully. I'm interested, as you see, President Mugabe returning himself to power in very questionable circumstances. What your thoughts are about that election?
I would say that I'm glad that our election in 1994 and the subsequent one, that those went as well as they did. I'm glad that I am a South African and not a Zimbabwean. I would say that what has taken place in Harare and in other parts of that beautiful country is questionable. But I would say we should probably wait for all of those observers to give their verdict. But I am sad. I am sad because Robert Mugabe was a star turn in Africa as one of the best of the leaders that we had.
I can tell you that the observers, the Norwegian observers, are saying that the election was very flawed. And I also noted in the same news story that the South African observers were saying, actually, it was okay, a few administrative difficulties. And I wanted to ask you about South Africa's unique relationship with Zimbabwe, perhaps even beyond that, to the relationship that these countries in Southern Africa have in supporting each other and when it is imperative that an Mbeki stand up and say, we need sanctions, we need to intervene, and when it is appropriate for the leaders to stand back and say, that's not our business.
Yeah. I think it is very difficult for people in other parts of the world to understand. You see, Robert Mugabe, in a sense, as it were, was cock of the walk for a very, very long time, and I think justifiably so. And then Nelson Mandela emerges from prison and immediately puts him in the shade, as he has done with virtually every other political leader. And that can't have gone down well. I mean, he's a kind of upstart. It's worse with Thabo Mbeki, who is younger, who, well, spent a lot of years in exile but not in jail. When he comes along, there's considerable constraint on what he can actually do without appearing to be the upstart who just wants to upset the apple cart. And there was the sensitivity which I think many people were not willing to acknowledge. But I myself would say that they probably gave President Mugabe a lot of leeway, a lot of scope for him to have backed away from the edge of the precipice. And that, in my view, the time had come where they ought to have spoken a great deal more sharply to him for the sake of the people and for the sake of the region and ultimately for the credibility of the call for the African Renaissance. I think that what has happened in Zimbabwe subverts Africa's credibility and erodes it further.
I'm glad you talked about the people. I was looking at the pictures over the weekend of the people in Harare lined up as they were for hours just to get the chance to vote. We forget about that, how important it is, what priority those people place on the privilege of being a part of a democracy. Yeah. It's in many ways a lesson for the West that for everything that Mugabe may have done in kicking journalists out, in subverting the Supreme Court, in sending his goons out into the fields, that the people, the voters, the citizens of Zimbabwe still show up to vote.
That's one of the exhilarating features. And perhaps when we are critical even of the governance in those countries, to say, you see, human beings don't need to be told that they were meant for freedom. Each one of us knows it instinctively, because that is how God created us. And you can see it so frequently where people have suffered under a dictatorship. Almost always they believe the next guy is really going to be the works. He's going to change their lives. And you see how they celebrate the fall of a dictator. Sadly, of course, I mean, they tend to have one dictator followed by another. But what gives me hope is precisely this deep, passionate commitment of the people to freedom. And that, in the end, that will prevail.
I want to ask you about your unique ability to understand both Africa and the West. You studied on a couple of occasions in the West. You have always struck me as someone who knew intuitively how to talk to the West, how to talk to Africa in ways that some of the rest of us feel very clumsy about doing. Because in the recent Commonwealth meeting, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said maybe we should have sanctions against Zimbabwe. And other African leaders there said, you know what, you have no credibility, or not much, being a former colonial power. We will decide, thank you very much, what works best for Africa. And then you have this specter of African leaders saying publicly, these are African rules. These are somehow different from other rules. And it puts people on the outside in an uncomfortable position because nobody wants to embrace that kind of second-class designation. But there it is coming from the mouths of the leaders.
Yes. I don't myself buy the argument that there is a special kind of democracy for Africa, there is a special kind of democracy for another part of the world. Human rights are human rights are human rights. And if an African violates the rights, inherent rights of people, he can't, or she can't, it's usually he can't use as an excuse the fact that we are in Africa. That's invalid. Human rights are universal or they are nothing. Yes, you may have peculiar ways of expressing that, but the fundamental right of a people to determine how they are going to be ruled is the same everywhere.
How does Mugabe get away with saying, these are my rules, I'm not going to take direction from anyone?
Yes. I don't think myself that he should. That it's as simple as that. Look at us in South Africa. We used to have a situation where Parliament was sovereign. Now we have said no. The Constitution is sovereign, so that when Parliament passes laws, even when they have passed the laws, as it were, validly, they followed the rules right through and have not cheated, it is left to the Constitutional Court to say whether that particular piece of legislation is consistent or not consistent with the Constitution. And they have already, in a number of instances, said, sorry, Parliament, sorry, government, despite all your majority, this clashes with the Constitution and we will not accept it. And I think that is what we are seeking to do. If they were really being honest, they would be saying that in Africa, actually, in the traditional setting, the good ruler was not the dictator. The good ruler was the one who had the capacity to work for consensus. Every single person in the village had the right to express their opinion. The ruler kept quiet. And then at the end, as it was summed it up, the good ruler was the guy then who said, this is my sense of what the community wants. That is the kind of democracy.
Connection listeners, you recognize the voice. My guest is Father Desmond Tutu. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll come back after our brief break, a chance to talk about the lessons learned in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and how those apply today. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My guest is Father Desmond Tutu. And I want to talk a little bit about what you take even now from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You were exhausted when it was over. You really were. They just
and I got sick, too. Yeah. I got cancer.
Prostate cancer. See, you sat too long. Do you think about it now? Do you think about it as an example for other parts of the world? Because I have to tell you, sitting as I do daily in this chair, when we're talking about stories from the Balkans, when we're talking about stories from Asia and elsewhere in Africa, the number of times people reference the work that you did in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in terms of finding that third way, that route towards restorative justice as opposed to retributive justice. It's remarkable.
Yes. Well, one, we were prayed for. We can't take all the credit. We overcame apartheid because the international community supported us. And one just wants to say a very big thank you to people for having supported us. And then when we came to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it wasn't just our own achievement. It was again the fact that around the world, we were being sustained by the love and the prayers of very many people. And that is quite crucial.
You said you couldn't have done it without that.
No.
It would not have succeeded.
It would be impossible. The extent of evil was almost palpable, you know. And one also wants to say that coming through that process, yes, one was devastated by the revelations of the kind of evil of which we are capable, making one deeply humble that I am where I am only by the grace of God. I can't look down on that perpetrator and dismiss him as being irredeemable. That we all have an incredible capacity for evil. But that's not the end of the story. This is one of the exciting things about the commission, that in fact it got one to realize that we have an incredible capacity for good, that people are made actually for goodness. People are, that is what the aberration is in fact the one who goes wrong. That God created us for transcendence, for love, for beauty, for laughter. That is why we admire not strong, macho, successful people. We admire a Mother Teresa, good people, Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, the Dalai Lama, that it is that we have an instinct for goodness. And that was the exciting thing about our Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I want to bring you to the topic of evil. It is a word that has been used considerably in the last few months after September 11th. It has taken on political weight, good and bad. You did, as you say, deal with the evil of apartheid, staring it down. People in this country and around the world see what happened on September 11th as another inherently evil act. And the response has been, and I'm going to steal a few of the words that you just gave to me, one of going back at it with the military might rather than looking for a way, any other way. I know you've spoken about this before, and I know that you have said that America has as much a capacity to lead with its compassion as it does with its military and its economic might. When you look at what's going on now, the war on terror, every day in the newspaper, is this the wrong way to go?
I think most of your people, in fact, deep down in their hearts, know it can't be the right way. You see, I mean, you can't say what was so reprehensible about September the 11th was particularly the fact that innocent, defenseless civilians were the targets. And everyone admits, and I admit, that that is what made September the 11th so horrendous. And then say, well, when innocent civilians, babies, mothers, grandfathers, in Afghanistan are targeted by your bombs, you then call it not civilians, you call it that awful obscenity, collateral damage. Now, I think, I mean, that is not good for you. Indeed, yes, we've got to fight terrorism. And one of the things that you did do, which we admired, was when you said it is something for the international community. We can't do it on our own. Now, you should have continued that way and said it ought to be the international community that determines what actions have got to be taken, not one country. And I mean, this is a great country. This is a country, I'm speaking not trying to psychologize you nicely and saying nice things. I have, as me and as a family, benefited incredibly from the generosity of people in this country. There is an incredible generosity and caringness here, which is what one would say, export that. Because why is this terror happening? In part, it is that people are made desperate by poverty, by hunger, by disease. And when they become desperate, people do desperate things.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Father Desmond Tutu. We're going to Newton now, and Felix is joining us. Hello, Felix.
Hello. Yes, I'm on the line.
Yes, you are, Felix.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Dick Gordon, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
And good morning, Bishop Tutu.
Good morning, sir.
I'm honored to have a chance to talk to you. With your moral authority over freedom and justice, not only in South Africa, but throughout Africa and the world, could you please explain to the listeners the fate of Nzwakhe Mbuli in the present South African Court of Justice? Is he a political prisoner or a criminal in your judgment? Anyway, for the sake of the listeners, you know, I would like to mention that Nzwakhe Mbuli is a poetic musician in South Africa, and his poetic lyrics of human freedom and conscience was one of the most effective unspoken forces that undermined the apartheid system.
Felix, I want to ask if Father Tutu knows of the case that
yes,
we're talking
about. I know.
Is there a larger lesson in this? Because we don't know the particulars.
Yes, I know Mbuli. He used to be called the people's poet. At many of the rallies, his poetry moved the people deeply. And he was arrested. And so far as it seems to be the case, he was tried in an open court where it seemed as if he had been involved in bank robbery, that they claim they found arms in his car and so on. And it seems to me that whilst there is doubt that they might have targeted him for his role in the struggle in the past, it appears that the evidence that was brought forth in the court seemed to be above board. I mean, I can't say more than the fact that I am very deeply saddened because that has happened to him.
But you've also said many times before that
yeah.
when the laws are there, you must respect
we've got to try to obey them.
Okay. 1-800-423-8255. Felix, thank you for your call to Boston, Massachusetts now. And Benjamin's joining us. Hello, Benjamin.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm just saying that I respect Tutu very much, but I strongly disagree with what he said with regards to Zimbabwe.
In what regard?
With regards to Zimbabwe, the president of Zimbabwe, I'm strongly opposed to that. And at the same time, I have to make the mention that I'm glad that for the first time, African leaders have decided to take things in their own hands instead of listening to the Western powers.
Benjamin, I want to be specific here. You disagree with the criticism of Robert Mugabe,
exactly.
Is that correct?
I strongly disagree with that.
And you think that all the tactics that Mr. Mugabe is accused of taking prior to the election in terms of pitching out journalists and firing Supreme Court justices, that's not a problem for you?
I don't think you're getting the right story, please. I don't think so. It will take us the whole session trying to prove that to be wrong or right. But what I'm saying is that it's not the true picture that people are seeing. I would like to remind you that Zimbabwe's economy was brought down by Britain because they refused to bring the money to buy the lands from the whites.
Benjamin, I'm going to read you a quote here that I had scribbled out from my notes yesterday. This is a political scientist speaking at the University of Zimbabwe. His name is Masapuli Sithole, and he said, you know, I'm quoting him here, "We can't live in the past. Whites are no longer our main problem. It is us." That's his quote.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is this. If you go back to the root of the problem, has nothing to do with white or black. The root of the problem is that who is to provide the money to buy the land from the whites? Britain accepted that they're going to provide the money, and they refuse to provide the money. They are urging Zimbabwean government to cough it out from their coffers.
Let's hear from Father Tutu on this.
I would say to you that yes, the whole question of the land issue is critical. And yet, you see, you don't right one wrong by doing a number of others. And we've got to be careful that we don't seem to see what is done by a black leader, even when it is reprehensible, it will be acceptable because it is done by him. I can't accept that because that in fact is accepting that we are somehow inferior. I mean, we've got to say that democracy has to do not just with voting. It has to do with saying you give the other side the opportunity of being able to express their point of view. You have the freedom of the press. You have an independent judiciary. You allow people the freedom to move, to congregate. And it seems that that didn't happen. And my own sadness is the fact that we seem to say that we have a different set of standards for one group of people, which doesn't apply to another. And we are getting back to what they used to do to us. And we've got to say, no, if something is wrong, then let's have the guts to be able to say it is wrong.
Benjamin, thank you for your call. We're going to the West Coast now. And from Spokane, Washington, David is joining us. Hello, David.
Good morning. It's an honor to speak with you, Father Tutu. My question is, my point really is that many Americans, assume that African nations like South Africa and Zimbabwe will sort of naturally strive towards a Western model of democracy. Yet many of us are disillusioned with our own system, and it is, in fact, deeply flawed. And I was wondering what you thought would be appropriate for us as Westerners to be taking from the South African and Zimbabwe experiences as they're currently unfolding. What would you like us to learn?
Well,
in ways maybe we can strive towards the ideals of democracy by exploring new paths, perhaps.
Yeah. One of the things, if I wanted to be very facetious, I would say start learning how to count.
That might be a good start.
You just might be able to decide who was, in fact, your president. But never mind. The point about democracy actually is participation. And in our country, one of the things we said was it is quite clear we shouldn't follow the Westminster type where you say winner takes all. It was quite crucial for our country that every stakeholder felt that they did have a stake in the proceedings, and that is why you had proportional representation. in South Africa, so that almost every constituency felt that their voice was going to be heard, even if it was muted. Whereas, in fact, the Western Westminster type, you participate only every 4 years or so, and with a kind of disillusionment that seems to have overtaken most of you, fewer and fewer of you, in fact, engage in the business of an election. And I would myself hope that you would not want to sit in the sidelines. You would say, this is my country. The decisions that are made on Capitol Hill impinge on my life, and I ought to be able to influence what happens there.
Do you see a similarity between the West and Africa, where people tend to believe that those decisions are in fact out of their hands? Once they voted, they're finished.
You know, in again, I mean, to refer to South Africa, they are trying to say people have to continue being interested. And this is where you require a vibrant civic society, where you have various organizations that can, in fact, make their voice heard. When legislation is proposed in South Africa, it is put out for general comment, and people have the right to come to Parliament at a particular stage so that they can make their point of view heard. Just to give you a small example, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the draft legislation said the amnesty hearings were going to have to be in camera. People were appalled, and civic society made their voice heard, and they got that changed.
David, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much as well.
Maybe we rely too much on radio talk shows as a way of discussing what should be done in Capitol and should be more involved. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Father Desmond Tutu, and we're back after this short break. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest, Father Desmond Tutu. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Danville, Virginia. Wilson is joining us. Hello, Wilson.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Good morning, sir. And good morning, Bishop Tutu.
Good morning.
I have admired you for many, many years. I am a retired Episcopal priest, like yourself.
Yes, Father.
And you and I have lived long enough to understand how short a human life is, and consequently how limited is our vision and our understanding. But on the other hand, you've lived through a great deal of history and participated in a great deal of history. So I have a philosophical question for you, and that is, are we improving as a human race? Are we actually getting better? When we see things like the attacks on the Trade Center in New York and the quality and quantity of our response as a nation, can we still see progress?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, part of it is how, when awful things happen, people don't sit back and say, tough luck.
Mm-hmm.
And even those who perpetrate evil don't go around boasting that they have done so. I mean, it's quite interesting that most people, I mean, if just think of anything that anybody has done which is evil, and they will not be brazen about it very infrequently, because, and this is something that you know so very well, because, in fact, we are made for goodness. You see, I mean, God created us for goodness, and last night somebody was telling me, a Jew was telling me, that in the Talmud, God creates the world, and on the sixth day, God says, I'm done. And the angels come to God and say, no, you can't say you're done. This is not finished. And God says, well, actually, let me tell you, I'm creating this human couple, and they are going to finish it off for me. That, in fact, God says we are God's fellow workers. And our God is so incredible that God becomes impotent. The omnipotent one becomes impotent because God waits on human partners such as you, I, and others. And when you think, you see, of, say, a Nelson Mandela, a Mother Teresa, and just to give spectacular examples, you see how, in fact, they roll back evil. And maybe if we take our Truth and Reconciliation Commission again, where the world was expecting an orgy of revenge and retribution, seeing the magnanimity of forgiveness and reconciliation, and people thrill. So I would say, of course, yes, there is a great deal of evil, but there is a great deal of good. I mean, I've been to places like Honduras where I've seen young Americans who have come out as members of the Peace Corps.
Yes.
Working away with no press, no publicity, working away and doing some incredible things. There is goodness. There is goodness. And I have no doubt at all, I mean, that this is a moral universe, and that goodness, that compassion, that generosity, they are going to have the last word, not the other things.
That's a wonderful response and gives great hope. I've been to Honduras, too, and I've seen the same thing.
And your own view, Wilson,
I agree with him entirely. I think, and the reason I wanted to ask him was because I like to be reinforced, because we live in a world that sometimes can become pretty pessimistic.
I agree with you.
And I wanted to hear him give that great statement of faith, because I believe it myself.
Thank you so much for calling.
I thank you.
God bless you.
God bless you, Bishop Tutu. Goodbye.
God bless you, Father.
1-800-423-8255 to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Philip is joining us. Hello, Philip.
Yes, hello. I wanted to say that I was very disappointed a moment ago to hear someone with the moral authority of Father Tutu equate the September 11th attacks with the U.S. Bombing in Afghanistan. Father Tutu said that U.S. bombs were targeting innocent women, children, and babies. And that is simply factually not the case. U.S. troops and bombs have never targeted any innocent civilians. Moreover, I'd like for Father Tutu to explain why is it that the Afghans themselves, the President, Karzai, Afghan expatriates who are returning to that country, in many cases after decades, if these people feel that the U.S. has liberated their country, how is it that he feels differently?
All I am trying to say, and I will hold on to this, innocent women and children have been killed. Is that a lie? I mean, is that not true? And
that is
all
true,
I am saying, and it isn't. I'm so sorry. Just wait.
Sir,
it isn't different. When you say I didn't do it intentionally, I did it intentionally. They are dead. And I think that one of the things that people here want to be very conscious of is you can actually win this war, but you will not win it if the only thing you want to do is to hit out, because it is caused not by mad fundamentalists. It is ultimately caused by the inequities of the world economic system. It is because people become desperate. People don't have clean water. People don't have food. People don't have accessible, affordable health care. And we spend obscene amounts on budgets of death when we know, and you know it too, that a small fraction of the budgets that are put into defense would ensure that children everywhere in the world had clean water, had enough to eat. And that is the point I am trying to make. And I'm saying that what is important about moral law is its universal validity. If it is wrong for innocent people to be killed, whether accidentally or intentionally here, it is wrong everywhere. And that is the point I am trying to make.
Philip, thanks so much for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to Malden, Massachusetts, and Tom is on the line. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I wanted to ask Father Tutu. First, I wanted to thank him so much for his really powerful words of inspiration, but to ask him what he would suggest or recommend that people who do oppose what our government is doing, specifically bombing and taking of civilian lives, how best to oppose that.
Yes. Well, in these countries such as yours, they care about what polls say, you know, and it is important that those who have different points of view actually express them and say that there is a different way of dealing with this problem, that people shouldn't, as it were, give up and say we are impotent, because the points of view that are prevailing at the moment are points of view of those who are ready to speak out. And so let those who hold contrary views also speak out, express. But of course, you see, my father used to say, improve your argument, don't raise your voice.
Tom, thank you for your call. I'm going to read you a quote of your own words, Father Tutu, that go back 2 years, a point we were discussing earlier in the hour when you had spent some time in the United States recovering from prostate cancer. You had finally returned to Cape Town, as you will be doing in a couple of months after this sojourn in the United States. And you said to a reporter at the airport in Cape Town, you said, "We have a cadre of outstanding new leaders. We oldies," your words, "certainly I should give them space to show off their worth. It is time," you said, "I move away from center stage."
I still believe that. I really do believe that. I believe that we should give people the chance to demonstrate the wonderful gifts that they do have. And unfortunately, it seems that now and again we have to comment and say, "Wow, guys," or praise them when they should be praised, and then put in a word of admonition when that should happen. But I, for myself, actually, I am seeking very much to have a reduced public profile, because I really, in fact, think I can do a great deal more now by being contemplative, by being more quiet, by trying to hold my nation, the world, hold it up in prayer, bring it before the throne of grace. I think that that is a work that I would want to be able to do. Because I actually think that the world is looking out for holiness, that we should be striving to have more people who are holy, people who are prayerful, people who are compassionate, who allow the compassion of God to work through them. And I would like to do a little bit of that.
Your own father, though, gave you advice that you can quote to me verbatim. Just as you, seen by so many of us as a father, have advice that you can tell by the way that people call our program today, want to hear. And I wonder if there isn't a little bit of Father Tutu that wants to roll his shoulders once in a while and say, boy, this is a lot of moral authority to carry around.
Fortunately, there are wonderful people who help to make one slightly more humble. My wife is very good at that. I went with her to West Point Military Academy, and they gave me a cap at the end, and it didn't fit. Most people would have said, well, the cap is too small. She said, his head is too big. It is good. And there are very many people praying, and they pray that one will become more and more supple in the hands of God. And I would want to respond to that divine grace more and more, and say, I've benefited so enormously from the love of so many, many, many people, and I would like to be able to reflect a little bit of that back to them.
Thank you so much for being part of our program today.
God bless you.
Father Desmond Tutu. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can do.